A Conspiracy of Lemurs, a Regal House publishing podcast that celebrates the writing craft. Co-hosted by myself, Janie Royal, founder and editor-in-chief at Regal House Publishing, and the editorial genius, Pam Van Dyke, Regal's managing editor. We are delighted today to welcome two of our Regal House authors, Carol Hafner and Rebecca Baum, to discuss the use of landscape, culture, and catastrophe as catalysts for character development, and how narrative point of view shapes the reader's experience of that journey. Pam, would you care to introduce our guest today?
It would be my pleasure. Rebecca is a native of Louisiana who's lived in New York City for over 20 years. In that time, she's worked in finance, studied writing, singing, and improv, authored several short stories and two novels. The most recent, Lifelike Creatures, which we will be discussing today, releases this month through Regal House Publishing. She currently lives in Greenwich Village with her husband and their cat. Booklist has this to say about Lifelike Creatures. Baum's impressive debut is plainly told in vivid descriptions and unapologetic language. She handles the struggle between love and blame and parent-child relationships honestly and beautifully in the face of addiction and environmental corruption. Welcome, Rebecca.
Thank you so much, Janie and Pam. It's wonderful to be here.
Carol Hafner is a Hollywood screenwriter and novelist with film credits writing long-form television for ABC, NBC, CBS, MTV, and the Disney Channel, including the Mary-Kate and Ashley movie Winning London. She has written original feature scripts for Paramount, TriStar, and Disney. Carol is also the author of two young adult novels, All You've Got and Surf Ed. In addition to writing, Carol has been a professor at Loyola Marymount University since 2010, and currently serves as chair of screenwriting. Her third YA novel, Knee Deep, which we will be discussing today, is also being released today. So happy book birthday, Carol.
Thank you.
Medium has this to say in part. Knee Deep is a love letter to New Orleans that is written for young adults and new adults, but will tug at the heartstrings of readers of all ages. Hafner's ability to create a young adult novel that is also an interracial romance, a historical fiction, and a paranormal thriller is astounding and creates a story that is unlike any other. We are so excited to have you both today. We have so much to talk about, so I'm going to kick it back to Janie and let you get started, Janie.
Thank you, Pam. Thank you. I am so excited about today's podcast. There's just some really, really cool things to discuss and really happy to have Rebecca and Carol with us. So, Carol, I was just thinking, in Knee Deep, you describe in poignant detail the effects of Hurricane Katrina on the residents of New Orleans and indeed the horror of the aftermath. And Rebecca, the disaster in Lifelike Creatures is no less impactful on the small town in Louisiana, a sinkhole that encompasses a staggering 37 acres created from the collapse of an underground salt dome cavern. I feel like narratives of this kind are important because they allow readers to feel a visceral engagement with fictional characters who are living through a climate crisis or a corporate-induced disaster, which in turn helps portray the real and present danger of climate change. And compelling fiction can be an agent for change, for promoting empathy in policymakers, for enabling readers to see and feel climate change or environmentally destructive corporate practices as more real, particularly if they're not witnessing the impact of these in their own backyard. So I'd love your thoughts on this.
I'd be happy to start, especially because I wanted to also just say congratulations, Carol. This is so amazing to be here with you on the day your book launches. I so enjoyed reading it. I love it. Everyone should read it. So I just wanted to take a moment and celebrate that.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's funny thinking about everything that's going on in our world today and, you know, how enormous these things can feel, whether it is something like an industrial disaster or a pandemic or severe, increasingly severe weather because of climate change. It can be so hard and overwhelming to even try to connect to those events, even if we want to. But to bring in the personal, to bring in the intimate experience, to see how individuals and families and communities are impacted is how we can connect to them. And you know, not just kind of numb out at the enormity of it. And then beyond that, yes, Janie, that's how policy changes occur.
I think it's really true that for young adults especially, they have grown up in a series of disasters. I mean, it's almost every year that there is a storm, or currently we've been having awful wildfires in California. And so I think that we all relate to those stories of survival and of the ones who don't. I've thought about this often in terms of what we're experiencing as a nation with COVID too, because at least with man-made disasters or the natural ones like Katrina that I wrote about, there's something physical that a character can fight against. You know, there's wind, there's water, or there's a sinkhole, right, Rebecca? But it's something physical rather than something in the air. And so I think it's why at this juncture, those kinds of stories really resonate with all of us, because they speak to the unknown that we're facing right now.
And most poignantly, too, to the human struggle against what may seem to be overwhelming odds. I mean, Mother Nature could not be more daunting in all of her fury. You know, whether it's the fires visited on the West Coast or the hurricanes on the East Coast, it's to bring that human element in is somehow also reassuring.
Yeah, Rebecca, you and I have talked about the research that we had to do and our different approaches. So would you talk a little bit about how you dealt with what you needed to know about the sinkhole in order to tell the story, what kind of research you did?
Sure. Yeah, thank you. I didn't actually even know I was going to be writing about a sinkhole when I began the story. It really began very intimately between Tara, the 13-year-old, and her mother, Joan, who, you know, struggles with addiction. I was writing the novel in a workshop, and the facilitator said, okay, great, you have brought this relationship and this home to life, but really you need to explore widening the lens now. And I'd already felt that I wanted to include the salt domes somehow, because I've always found them really fascinating and mysterious, these giant salt deposits that extend for miles and miles into the earth. And as I was reading about that, I came across, you know, sinkholes. There have been sinkholes that opened up in salt domes a few times in Louisiana, and most recently the Bayou Corn sinkhole, which was really devastating to this beautiful little community in southern Louisiana. And I was really touched by it. I also thought the sinkhole as reflective of the parent-child relationship I was describing, and the addiction and the unpredictability. I mean, the Bayou Corn sinkhole was an unprecedented event. So there were a lot of unknowns. So I thought I could, it's weird to use the word, you know, be inspired by this tragedy, but it seemed like a way to explore Tara and Joan's relationship and the community within which they lived. And luckily, I have a friend who's a geologist, and I modeled the basic sinkhole event on Bayou Corn, but then the specifics of it are very different. For instance, the sinkhole in my story happens very close to Tara and Joan's property, and Bayou Corn was a bit distant from the town itself. So, you know, I would call my friend up, hey, can I, you know, can this happen? Can they have to drill something right in Tara and Joan's backyard? Can this collapse happen at this point? What would trigger that? So that was the sort of research. And of course, you know, reading articles and one really iconic YouTube image of these cypress trees just plummeting straight down into the water when the sinkhole, the Bayou Corn sinkhole itself opened up. But what about you, Carol? I mean, I know, God, it must have been challenging because there was so much material to explore.
Well, and it was very different because I was working and relating about an actual event about Katrina. And actually, I began work on the novel 15 years ago, right after Katrina. I witnessed it from afar on my couch, safely cocooned in Los Angeles, but I watched continual news footage for about 5 days. I couldn't take my eyes off the screen. I had been in love with New Orleans for a very long time, since I was 16, actually, my first trip, which was followed by many others at different times and ages in my life. And I was told once by a friend of mine who's this Hungarian historical architect and is also president of ELTE, which is the Yale of Hungary, but he was writing a book on the notion that cities have souls, that they are more than infrastructure and building and highways and streets, that they're culture and music and foods and smells and something that kind of surpasses the physical. I was blown away because I have always talked about the cities I love like they were ex-lovers. You know, it's like I'm married to Los Angeles, but I got this thing with New York, you know, and New Orleans was always special because she was my first one. She was the first city I felt that connection to. So I watched Katrina with a sadness that just overwhelmed me. And when the levee broke, I broke down. And my grief was honestly so strong that my family began to worry about me. And I decided I was going to write a Katrina story. I didn't know what it was, but I went down to New Orleans about, I don't know, 6 or 7 months after. I drove into the Ninth Ward or had a cabbie. I finally found a cabbie who would take me there. And I swear I saw the steps to the shotgun house that I had danced in my 20s, which was no more. I mean, it was just all devastated. And so I spent a lot of time talking to people that I knew and then just strangers too, because the one thing about New Orleans is everybody will talk. I mean, you know, you go to bars, you go to cafes, they're all so red. It's all Louisiana, right, Rebecca? I mean, it's just those people talk. They eat and they talk. Those two things you can guarantee. And so I was talking to survivors, listening to their stories, and I came home. I combed the internet looking for, postings and personal things. And I gathered a lot of material. And it was these strange details that would just stick with me and haunt me. Like there was a woman I talked to at a bar who had stayed during the storm. She hadn't evacuated and she had stayed in the quarter. And she talked about when the storm passed and when the water receded and that she walked out and how the quarter really did much better than a whole lot of other parts of the city. But she said there was this silence because there was no bird song. The birds had all gone. And she said it was so strange. And you think about it, because anytime you walk outside a big city, country, whatever, there are bird sounds. And she said it was replaced by this airy silence. Well, that was a detail I did use in the book because it struck me so much. But anyway, I went home and I started to write. And I wrote, I think the first two chapters, I found Camille. She came pretty easily. And then I couldn't do it. I had to put the novel away because I realized that the first stories that came out of Katrina had to have been from people who lived it, that they had earned the right to tell that story first. And so I didn't pick up the manuscript again until 10 years later. When I felt like enough time had passed that I could tell the story of Camille with Katrina as sort of the metaphor for all of the disasters that, you know, we're experiencing. So, yeah, it was quite the journey.
Wow. So interesting. You know, and I was in New Orleans, the 10th anniversary of Katrina, and it was so much had not been repaired still, particularly in the Ninth Ward. And my daughter lives there now. She's been there for 3 years. And one thing I will have to say, I agree with you, Carol. I mean, if any city has a soul, and I agree with you, many do, New Orleans is definitely one of those for sure.
It's one of the old souls.
Yeah.
And what a marvelous story of resilience and survival. I mean, that inspires all of us, you know. But one of many things that I loved about both of your novels is the way that you both depict characters living on the fringe, you know, who are under stress. And I think that some narratives are problematic, not for the lives that they describe, but for those that they leave out. The language of policy speak, for example, doesn't leave much room for the human condition. And when a hurricane like Katrina hits, Congress and federal agencies respond in terms of dollars of damage rather than the impacts on people. And assistance is provided to those who manage to get to the front of the line, who can afford to relocate, check into a hotel, access their records online, file disaster paperwork within days of the event, immediately tapping into FEMA assistance. Particularly for Americans on the margins who are subsisting on minimum wage, who struggle after such a disaster, to simply find a safe place to move their family. It is an entirely different process for them. And it seems that the way that we're tackling climate-related problems widens existing inequities. And most public narratives don't capture that. But fiction can. And both of your books do. And I love that about your novels.
Well, it's true, Janie. I mean, I think what you said is true. And it leads me to another question, actually. It seems that the Gulf Coast and the Gulf South is uniquely vulnerable to disaster. And I saw this play out after in a number of what I think of as post-Katrina novels. There's Jesmyn Ward's Salvage the Bones, where a family is waiting for the hurricane to come, and C. Morgan Batt's novel, A Floating World, also deals with Katrina. But even before that, we had Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath, you know, where there was a forced migration due to an environmental disaster, the Dust Bowl, caused by overfertilization. And, you know, man's hubris is obviously at play here. But it does lead me to wonder, and I want to ask you both, in fiction, what is it about the pressures or constraints of a disaster, natural or man-made, that works with a novel in terms of character development? Carol, I'll start with you on that.
Well, I think for me, I mean, it was Camille sort of burst onto the scene full-blown, which I've never really had happen before. Generally, I spend a lot of time really thinking about the character and sort of creating character bios or whatever. And she just organically appeared. And her voice was so strong that I very shortly decided I had to write it as a memoir. I had to write it in first person, which that decision and that sort of character decision impacted the entire structure of the novel. And it also impacted the way I told the story of the natural disaster, because I realized that since she was telling the story and I wanted it to progress in a chronological order, she could only know what she knew when she knew it. So the structure of the novel became like a series of those Russian wooden nesting dolls, so that there are stories within stories within stories. So she learns, because she does evacuate the hurricane and does not experience it firsthand. She learns about it from her father, from Antoine, from Gina, later on at different points. And that character decision allowed me to tell the story of Katrina in very personal stories. So we don't ever really do the whole, you know, it's not like this happens and this happens. I had to have the timeline. I definitely had the timeline out there, and I had to fit everybody's position into the timeline of what actually happened. But the stories that I'm telling are very, they're small in that they're one person or two people or three, and how they survive the storm or how they don't.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's interesting. And just, we'll keep going with this point of view question, because Camille's story obviously is told in her own words. And I'll just want to read this little bit from the back cover, if I may. This is the story of what happened to me on Fat Tuesday, how I ended up on the steps of St. Mary's, the hem of my pirate's petticoat soaked in someone else's blood. Although I know the story to be true, I don't totally believe it myself. Like all good tales born out of the bayou, mine involves the dead, the living, and the one trapped in the brackish waters between heaven and hell. It is the story of true love and true disaster, and at the end of it, I'll leave it up to you to decide which is the harder to survive. Which I think is great, and I think it's interesting that you chose first-person point of view, and I thought it was done quite well, too, because we do get a sense of the disaster, although Camille isn't there when it's actually happening, because of the way you've chosen to let other characters in the story tell the reader what she missed. But she feels it all the same because she's very close to these people that who are telling her these stories. And I want to transition to Lifelike Creatures, Rebecca, and I'm going to read a little bit of an abridged version of the back cover of your book as well so that our listeners just get a sense of what the book is about. 13-year-old Tara does whatever it takes to keep her beautiful, audacious, and addicted mother, Joan, from falling through the cracks, fending off bill collectors, heating meals in the cast iron skillet, and tending to their ramshackle home. Tara steers them safely through Joan's drug and alcohol binges. When a sinkhole forces her rural Louisiana town to evacuate, Tara finds herself homeless and her mother's impulsive personality unleashed. But Joan's raw charisma and plain speak quickly establish her as the public face of the catastrophe. But as the spotlight intensifies and the promise of settlement looms, Joan's demons return with a vengeance. Tara must decide whether to pull her mother from the brink as she has always done or let her fall, severing ties with the only family she's ever known. So, Rebecca, your book is told in third person, alternating points of view. And I was hoping that you might tell our listeners about why you made that choice. Why alternating points of view versus just from Tara's point of view?
Sure, absolutely. It kind of was a decision that the story made for me. I wrote Lifelike Creatures in a wonderful writing workshop. And for the first, you know, the first third of the book, I was very clearly in Tara's point of view. And as I started to get into the middle of the story, the middle third, if you will, I kept, you know, I would bring my pages in to the workshop, and the facilitator, Jeff, would say, you know, you keep drifting into Joan's perspective. And I was really struggling with it and like trying to be more disciplined, you know, and I kept trying, and I really thought it was a matter of craft, which I did want to say, I thought, you know, Carol, the way that she's able to have the other characters tell the story is an example of beautiful craft work. But with my story, I was really trying to wrangle myself back into Tara's POV and feeling like I was failing because I was bringing in pages and being told, no, we're back in Joan's POV. And finally, Jeff said, why don't you just allow it? You're being pulled in that direction. Why don't you just go with that flow? And man, it was so freeing when I decided to take that suggestion, and ended up being really fun. I mean, Joan is a very different character from her daughter, Tara. And, you know, some of the stuff that comes out of her mouth is quite unvarnished. So I think it ended up working really well. And then, of course, you know, we have to go back to Tara. We have to get back into her POV for the end of the story, because she hopefully has really grabbed our hearts in the beginning. So,
And I'd like to just sort of jump in and add, first of all, full disclosure, you probably can tell Rebecca and I both really love each other's books. Otherwise, I guess we wouldn't be doing this podcast, or maybe we would, and it would be a totally different kind of podcast. But I was so hooked in to Tara, and she's so sympathetic, and you feel so deeply for her. And so initially, when we shift into Joan, I'm kind of like, oh, I miss Tara. But Joan is such a mess and is so interesting that I really enjoyed that trip. But about midway through Joan, I kind of thumbed to the back of the book to see if we were going to go back to Tara again, because I missed her so much. I was like, you got to get me back to Tara. I got to go back to her. So I didn't read ahead, but I did see that, oh, we're going back to her point of view. And so then I could relax into Joan and enjoy the ride, because she is a trip. She is a ride.
She is. I think we need Joan's point of view, frankly, because I think it strengthens our empathy and sympathy for Tara. And it draws the reader through the book in such a way that you just need to know Tara's okay in the end. We've talked about this in other podcasts about writing from a younger person's point of view, that their worldview is a little smaller than an adult's worldview. And so Joan gives us a little bit of that as well. She's a bit of a cynic, and she gives us some of what I'm not sure Tara would have been able to do as a 13-year-old. So yeah, thank you both for that. That's so interesting. I love talking about point of view, because I think it's one of those things that, you know, authors say that they just know from the get-go, but I don't believe that. I think it's a craft choice in some ways. I know, Carol, you said Camille's voice came to you first person and she was right there. And that's great. But I also think you would have figured that out anyway, probably, if you had started to write Camille in third person. You would have been writing it thinking, I know, I need it. She's speaking to me. And I feel that when I read your book, you were sort of channeling Camille through that whole process.
She really, and actually I did begin the book in third person. I mean, that was my intention. It was always my intention to do it. And it sort of, it did shift. And I think, I hope I'm not misquoting, but I think Margaret Atwood said that the point of view is the most important decision that a novelist makes. And I totally ascribe to it. And I think it really is. It determines everything. And it also gives you, I mean, once you settle on that point of view, then you know your way into the story. And in a way, you know your way out too. So I agree with that. One of the interesting consequences of that I just recently discovered, and I think it's because, Rebecca, in getting to know you and our discussions we've had, your insight into my work has made me more critically aware of what I did. You know, I've really sort of thought about, why did you do that? You know, was this intentional, or how did that happen exactly? But I realized in retrospect, originally I had put Camille in the storm. She, in fact, sort of lived through many of the things that happened to Antoine currently in the book, happened to her. And I changed it midway through and had her evacuate, and all these stories come in different ways of what actually happens during the storm. And I realize now, I think I did it because Camille's experiences then mirrored my own, because I watched the storm from afar. I wasn't present. So I, like Camille, had to piece together from the people I love what happened.
Carol, there's this scene in your novel where Antoine appears to Camille under the Evangeline Oak, and he describes his final hours in Orleans after the hurricane hit. Of course, the Evangeline Oak in the town center of St. Martinville, Louisiana, is a legendary meeting place of the two lovers, Evangeline and Gabriel, from Henry Longfellow's epic poem, Evangeline. And when you're speaking just then, it reminded me of what Longfellow said of his poem. He said, "I had the fever a long time burning in my own brain before I let my hero take it. Evangeline is so easy for you to read because it was so hard for me to write."
That is lovely. And I chose St. Martinville for her cousins to live there, because my mother had taken me to the Evangeline Oak. That was a place that was very special to her too. And so I had to sort of research and make sure that that place was still okay during the, you know, they could have evacuated there and that would have worked. But I did it specifically for that. It symbolizes lover's tryst, and also love stories that don't work out. Certainly not the way they were intended, or not what they were hoped for. So it seemed like the perfect place. I think writing Antoine's experiences, though, were the hardest. His experience during the storm broke my heart every time I had to go there, because it didn't have to happen.
One of the things that I loved about your novel, Carol, and of course there are many, many things that I loved about your novel, but it seems that there is this marvelous fluidity between your characters in terms of the POV. Well, it was written indubitably from Camille's perspective, and we're very much entrenched in that character. You know, Antoine appears to her as a ghost, literally, and we get a sense of his experience, and then we learn of his grandmother's experience on the bridge, and it's all interwoven in this lovely, fluid manner where you're intertwining threads of the past and the present, of the actual and the imagined, of ghosts versus, you know, those who are in the land of the living. And it's done in such a way which strikes me as really poetic. And I wonder if that was intentional or if that came about during the writing process.
I had to find each of the characters' stories, you know, what was going to happen to them during the storm. And as I said before, originally, what happened to Antoine was going to happen to Camille. And then I decided that, no, this would be his moment, and that it had to be told. It was much stronger told between just he and him, his relating the story of what happened in the attic of his great aunt's home during the storm. Every time I had to write and rewrite, I do a lot of rewriting, so I go back to things a lot. It always broke my heart to tell his story, especially because what happened to him didn't have to happen. And I think, Janie, that his retelling of what happened is the longest one in the book. It's a full chapter at least, maybe a little more. It's actually a little more than a full chapter. And I think it contains the heart of the storm, which was not the storm itself, but what happened after, and the water. And Knee Deep is ultimately a lot about water.
Yes, and you can't tell that story without relating the experience of being there in it, because it's incomplete without that experience. And it's brave to tell it. And as I mentioned earlier, I love that you told it from the point of view of a family and an individual who were really, getting out wasn't easy. You know, they had cats and family and didn't necessarily have a car or gas, or it was damn complicated. And it was hard. And you know, that's when you really see that struggle, which is so poignantly highlighted.
Mm-hmm. Well, because Annie Shea just wouldn't leave without King Oliver. You know, it was the damn cat, you know.
Oh, yes. Well, and from a craft perspective, Carol, it's so interesting because you were able to show what happened to so many people during Katrina and in many other disasters. And you used the ghost of Antoine to be able to tell that story, which I thought was so interesting, because otherwise his story would have ended in a way. His ghost is really critical to the plot. I thought it was a really interesting craft approach. What made you decide to make Antoine become a ghost in the novel?
I think it has something to do with something that actually Rebecca and I have discussed about literal ghosts and shades of the past. And I wanted to explore this notion that I guess has sort of grown into a belief that in a relationship, I think someone always loves someone more. In my own marriage, I know, and I've been married a long time. I'm not even sure how many years, but I do know I have grown children. And when I first married, I loved my husband more than he loved me. And over time, he began to love me more than I did him. And I can say with absolute conviction, I prefer the latter. It is so much better to be adored. But it led me to the question of what do you do when you're 16 and you love someone more than they love you? And there are lots of stories, I think, about loving someone who doesn't love you, but there aren't that many about what if they don't or can't love you enough. And so in a way, I had to make him a ghost so that Camille could possess him in life, I mean, in death, in a way that she could not in life. And that she had to reconcile what she imagined him to be and who he was, and also who he would have become. I think that that's probably the biggest tragedy of the book, is the recognition of what kind of man he would have become, which would have been the kind of man we need more of in the world. So that was basically my decision. I did not go into this to write a paranormal and to have, you know, spirits of dead voodoo queens going around. I mean, that it was not my intent at all, because I really don't like delving into all magic and supernatural and having to create the rules of the world in that world. So I was more drawn to it because it seemed the best way to tell the core story that I wanted to tell.
And of course, when you talk about New Orleans soul, the living and the dead, which are very much a part of the present life in that city, the funerals and the graveyards and the voodoo queens, I mean, that to me really summoned up this evocative notion of what New Orleans was all about. So I think that it all worked perfectly in your novel.
Yes, I was going to say this. I agree with Janie and Rebecca. Even if you didn't set out to write a story with some para, you know, normal elements, it works so well in the setting that you create there. So it seemed that there was just no other way to write it. I'm sure that's a nod to your ability and your craft, I say. But sticking on the character theme of character, Rebecca, let's talk about Joan. I'd like to talk about Joan now, if that's okay. So I know you spoke earlier about why you ended up writing Joan's point of view, because, and it sounds like she was a character who would not be silenced. So you had to write about her. And she's a wise character in a lot of ways. She's out for number one and with Tara under her wing, but she is going to take what is hers. This is the feeling I had with her the entire time. And she makes some missteps along the way. And she does some things that I don't want to give anything away. So I'm not going to say what she does. I don't want to give any spoilers. But when you write a character, I think the best novels, even though a character might be someone we wouldn't necessarily enjoy knowing in person, you do have to make them human. They can't be completely irredeemable. I don't believe that good novels do that. So can you talk about how you made Joan a likable character? And she is a likable character, even though she has many, many issues.
Yes, sure. Thank you. I think, you know, Joan is fun because she's very feral in a lot of ways. She says some things we might want to say or we might think, and she is unable to stop herself a lot of the times. She is very dynamic. She doesn't necessarily want anyone's approval. She's willing to allow herself to be groomed by Lydia, the class action lawyer, to a degree. When she starts to feel attention shifting elsewhere, because it is a class action, you know, it's not like Joan is Lydia's only client. She quickly reorients and pivots to something that's more, puts her at the forefront, if you will. She's got a horrible origin story. She was sold as a gambling debt by her horrible father to another horrible man who was far too old for her. So she's, you know, she lived her early life was miserable, and And she's going to grab as much as she can. She's going to enjoy as much as she can. And a lot, and that includes alcohol and drugs. She's pleasure seeking. She's fun seeking. And she doesn't want to have to play by anyone else's rules. And she does love her daughter. She does love her daughter as much as she is capable of loving her.
Yes, you definitely get that from her point of view. You bring up a good point, and I was just thinking as you were talking that perhaps what it is that makes what in a lesser work would be called an irredeemable character, perhaps what makes a character redeemable is that the reader understands her motivations because we have her backstory. We know what happened to her. And this is another great choice on your part, Rebecca, was to give her a point of view because Tara, she might have a little bit of the backstory, but she wouldn't understand that history. She wouldn't understand what that meant. She's too young for that. So maybe it is a little bit of this idea that we need to know what drives a character, not just in their present day, but what drives them, what motivates them from before, when they were younger, when they were children, when they were teenagers and young adults, etc.
I was going to ask, because I'm not sure how you did it, but there was also, I think, craft involved with Joan. And one of the reasons that she does feel so redeemable is obviously the backstory. And Pam's absolutely right about that. But you also keep making the reader believe that she could do or be better.
Yes. And Tara too. Like, we're like Tara, like, man, is she going to pull this off? It's like, she really is the face of this disaster. She's getting attention. People are galvanizing around her.
You know, one thing that strikes me listening to you both is, you know, I've been thinking about hope and despair and how they form narrative threads in your novels. And initially, I was thinking of it from a structural point of view that, you know, books have a middle, a beginning, an end, and often it's the end part that seems to generate the most controversy. Are we going to end up in a hopeful place? Are we going to end up in a despairing end of times kind of place? And what strikes me now listening to you is that it's not just a structural question or a plot development. It's also a question of the way the characters develop and the characters themselves who are also torn between hope and despair, this sort of emotional pendulum, which you encounter in these characters, which are really interesting because you see that struggle themselves, you know, between hope and despair in Joan, in Tara, in Camille, and in Antoine. And I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, Kara, you actually shared a beautiful concept of how that drives the narrative, an image you shared with me. Do you remember that?
I remember talking about leading the reader between hope and fear, that's a way of creating internal tension and conflict within scenes and within character development, and that it also keeps the reader incredibly engaged because you're simultaneously hoping for this one thing, but you're fearing something else. And oftentimes, of course, what happens is something entirely different, so that then you're hoping for something else and fearing something else. But I think that tension is what makes us turn pages.
Yes, I agree. It's that sort of polar opposites, hope and despair, but it's almost like listening to a person whose voice is musical versus someone who's speaking in monotone. You need the ups and downs to make a novel really work. You can't have constantly rising tension without some hope in there, because a reader would become very tired very quickly. I mean, unless you're a big thriller reader or something, but and that's fine too. But I do think that the weaving of those two together not only strengthens the character, but it pulls the reader through. It keeps the reader going. What if we're at a place of fear? We know we want to get to a place of hope. So it's back and forth and back and forth. So, and both of you've done that very well in your works.
Well, and if you think about it, it's also really reflected in any disaster coverage you see, right? It's whatever it is, there is always an element of hope of someone who did survive or someone who finds that one thing that, you know, survives the fire, that one photograph or whatever. But we witness that, or journalists know that they need to kind of pull that out too. They got to find that amidst the rubble and the destruction, because I guess we all need hope, you know? We need that thread.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's so true. And I think that's why we read novels too, you know, to hear someone's story and what they're going through, but also come out on the other end of it feeling that there is hope out there.
Yeah. And in some ways, I think human beings can't help, but they can't help themselves. It's a biological imperative to hope. It pushes humanity forward.
I think particularly when these struggles are so monumental, where a sinkhole that nobody can control, nobody knows how it's going to expand. It's like a landscape monster that is swallowing towns whole. And then Katrina, the fury of nature unleashed upon humankind. Without that measure of hope, I think it's entirely bleak and overwhelming.
Agree. Yes, I agree. I have one final question. Both of you, I think, Rebecca, you grew up, or at least were born in Louisiana, correct?
Yes, I lived there until I was 18.
And Carol, you grew up in Texas, is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Great. So I was curious because I was reading in the Southern Quarterly about, you know, expat Southern writers like Robin Penn Warren and Dorothy Allison and Alice Walker, to name a few. And the article mentioned that maybe writers are better able to articulate unique viewpoints about the South. And then I sort of added, possibly because they are writing about it from afar. And I wondered if both of you would speak to that. Rebecca, you want to start?
Sure. You know, I still, when I talk about going to visit my family, my mom's in New Orleans, my siblings are in New Orleans, and I have extended family in Lafayette and Baton Rouge and other areas. And when I speak about going to visit, I say I'm going home. I mean, I've been gone for like over half my life, and I still, you know, refer to it as home. And I do think particularly growing up in the rural South, it's just interwoven in your DNA and your nervous system as you develop, and it's always with you. And at the same time, some part of me always felt the urge to leave, the urge to see the broader world. Part of my journey was to step outside of the world that I knew so intimately. So I think with that is some sense of like some kind of outsider status for whatever reason. And maybe we all have that, but I certainly had it and I listened to it. My first two novels are about the South. You know, I had to go back. I had to explore. I don't know if it makes me a better storyteller or gives me more insight, but I personally had to revisit that. Reading and writing is how I organize and understand and make sense of the world. And I hope that perhaps this novel, you know, will do that for someone else, for other readers about the South and about the larger world.
Well, it's interesting, Rebecca, when you said that you have now lived half your life, you know, outside. So have I. And when I realized I had lived longer in Los Angeles than I had lived in Texas, it just felt wrong. I couldn't really quite conceive. And I was incredibly fortunate growing up in that I experienced both Dallas. I was born and raised in Dallas, but all of our relatives lived in this little bitty Texas town, Henrietta, Texas. And I spent every holiday, I spent all the summers. So I grew up with two identities. I had two sets of friends. And when I went to the little town and I was 14, I could pretend I was 16. There were all kinds of advantages. I felt like a little town girl and a big city girl all at the same time, and having both of those. And of course, the small Texas town, Henrietta, is very Texas, you know, more so than Dallas. I mean, it is really tech. I mean, there are rodeos, and I mean, like, small rodeos and VFW dances and all of that. So I think that growing up in Texas and having connections to the South and to Louisiana does give you a certain kind of lens and perspective. And you may be right, Rebecca, that it's only that it crystallized when you move away. The first, not the first screenplay I wrote, but the first one that really got attention was called Faded Love, and it takes place in that small little Texas town. And I think to date, it's probably been optioned about 10 times. It's a really small story. It's Tender Mercies. It's too little to make into a big movie, I think. But people love the, I don't know, I guess the connection or the authentic nature, the soul of the story. And I don't think a writer has to be from a certain place to write about a certain place or to write about a certain kind of character or a certain situation. But I do think a writer has to find and feel a deep connection to the place, to the story, in order to be able to do it justice. I ask my writers, the writers I teach, that they have to answer three questions before they begin a project. And the first is, what is the story you want to tell? The second is, why do you want to tell it? And the third is, why are you the best person to tell that story? And that's where the connection comes in. You have to feel the connection.
Wonderful. I love that. Actually, those are great questions. I dabble in writing, and I think maybe I should pose those to myself. Rebecca, what do you have any words of advice that you would give new writers, emerging writers?
I found it really helpful to be in a workshop. I mean, this is a very practical piece of advice, but the community and the accountability for this first novel really worked for me. And I feel that I learned to write a novel as I was writing a novel.
So, Carol and Rebecca, would love to hear a little excerpt of you reading from your works. Do you have a section prepared, Rebecca, that you'd like to start us off with?
Love to. Thank you. This excerpt starts when Tara is taken up in a helicopter with a representative of Mid-South, and she and her mother are being shown the sinkhole from above. The earth heaved and fell away as the helicopter took flight. Tara was strapped up front next to Eddie, her ears shielded from the noise of the blades by a chunky headset. She'd almost missed the moment when they left the ground, riveted as she was by Eddie's cool command of the aircraft, the precision of his fingers over the toggles and gauges of black steel, and how he seemed at once both vigilant and at ease. The pilot who'd delivered the helicopter now occupied the rear with her mother, who kept grasping reflexively for her cigarettes. Tara was surprised that she'd accepted Eddie's invitation. Her mother hated heights and wouldn't even brave the tiny Ferris wheel at the annual church fair. No smoking, the pilot politely reminded her mother as she brandished a cigarette. It's against federal law. Joan, Eddie chided through his headset, I had to pull a few strings to get y'all up here. Don't get me in trouble for it. You'll be in more trouble if I keel over and die from nerves, she replied, her light ash brows peaked with agitation. Besides, I ain't gonna light it. Eddie maneuvered the craft above their house. The rotor beat the air and a flock of plastic grocery bags blew from beneath the carport and sailed across the yard. As the helicopter pivoted to the south with dragonfly quickness, an electric hum infused Tara's skin, her cells, her whole body. She leaned forward and spotted Mrs. Honoré's house with its hulking barn and ancient live oaks. Her property marked the eastern flank of Terrafine. Beyond her woods lived the swamp, thick with burnt emeralds and mossy greens of cypress, maple, and black gum trees. Abruptly, the shadow of a swift-moving cloud engulfed the swamp forest, dousing the land in faded blue. A sigh filled Tara's headset. Eddie chuckled, and she realized the sigh had been her own. "Different from an airplane, isn't it?" His voice through the headset had a thin, insectile quality. "I wouldn't know." She wiped her exhale from the cockpit window. "Really? First time flying?" His lips were obscured by the mouthpiece, but his eyes held no trace of mockery. "Uh-huh," Tara replied. "What about you, Joan?" he asked as he angled the copter south. "Bus is good enough for me, thank you very much. Better yet, my own truck." Her mother's voice was calmer, and she'd settled into her seat, the unlit cigarette resting between her curled fingers. Tara tapped the altimeter. 1,500 feet above the earth, above Terrafine, above all she'd ever known and done. Her life played out on a plot of dirt that Eddie in his helicopter could break free of in a heartbeat. She lifted her gaze to her left and the farthest point on the horizon, where a spill of gold melted into the sapphire sky. "What's that?" she asked. The glass was cool against her fingertip. "The Gulf of Mexico. And after that? Let's see. Mexico, Central America, South America. And after about 8,000 miles, you'll hit Antarctica and the South Pole," Tara finished. "The ends of the earth." "That's right." This time she could see his smile. "I wish we could make it a longer ride, but Davis back there is scheduled to take up a survey team." "I know," Tara replied. Not because she did, but to distract from the ache she felt as the helicopter gently tilted and the Gulf slid from view. As Eddie brought them lower, a curdled blight appeared on the lush surroundings of field and forest. "That's it," he said. "The sinkhole."
Wow, it was beautiful. So nice.
Carol, do you have an excerpt you'd like to read?
Yes, I do. This is one of my stories within the stories, one of the Russian nesting dolls. But this occurs when Camille's father reunites with them in St. Martinville and describes what happened to him and to Bama's sister, Annie Shea. "Through the screen, we could see my daddy. His face was sunburned, his pants caked with mud. He turned and waved goodbye to the trucker who had given him a ride in his 18-wheeler from the bus stop in Lafayette. I strained to see if anybody else was with him, but he was alone. In that moment, I realized how ridiculous I'd been to think he'd be able to find Annie Shea in the disaster that had been our city. I also began to reconsider everything that had happened. In that doubt arose a flutter of hope. Maybe I had dreamed the whole thing, and maybe Antoine was still alive." "Good Lord, Donald, what happened to your shoes?" Mary Ellen asked, noticing he was barefoot. "Well, I guess I lost them, probably when I was wading through the waters." "I have some news," he said, and gestured to Bama to sit with him on the couch. My heart was racing. He cradled Bama's hands in his own, speaking in a voice so gentle it almost sounded like a lullaby. "I found your sister on the big overpass that connects Treme to the Ninth Ward." So that much was true. "She was pretty weak when I got there. She'd been through a lot. And she lasted another 3 or 4 hours as we waited for help to come." "Shay Shay is dead," Bama said quietly. "I was holding her in my arms when she passed. I want you to know that she did not die alone, that she was with family." He said it as if that were important, and I guess it was to Bama, because she seemed comforted. "Was she scared, Mama?" Bama asked. "No, she went gently, like a babe going to sleep," he answered. "What did you do with her body?" "When the first bus came, I asked the driver if he could bring her with me, but he said no. He could only evacuate a third of those on the bridge as it was. So I gave up my spot on the bus and decided to wait for the next one in order to take care of your sister. trembling with emotion, Bama punctuated his story with mumbled thank yous. There was a patch of dry land on the slope going down to the underpass, so I carried her there and laid her on the damp grass. I found a tarp among the wreckage and covered her, securing it with pieces of broken brick, what was left of somebody's chimney. Then I went back to the bridge and asked if anyone had a pen or something I could write with. Sure enough, halfway across the overpass, I found a kid with a Sharpie. I asked him if I could borrow it for a minute and promised to bring it right back, but he was reluctant. His cell was gone. He didn't have any water or food or even a flashlight, but he had this one thing, this Sharpie pen, and he didn't want to let go of the last thing he owned. I promised him that if he would let me use his pen, that on his 18th birthday, he could come down to the quarter and drink for free at my bar. He stared at me long and hard. How do I know you even own a bar? Well, you don't, I said, but I do, and that's the truth. And he said, yeah, well, your deal's only good if you survive this mess. Who knows what's coming next? I said, whatever it is, I have to survive it, because if I don't, my wife will kill me. Mary Ellen smiled and laid her hand on his shoulder. I told the young man that I had made a grave for an old friend, a lady old enough to be his grandmother, who had died on the bridge, and I needed to mark her passing so that when this was all over, her sister could claim the body and give her a proper burial. He walked with me to Annie Shea's temporary resting place. He still wouldn't let me have his pen, but he agreed to write the epitaph himself. We kept it simple, so as not to use much ink. I told him to write, "Here lies Sharon Williams, lover of animals, friend to all." But what about my Antoine? Why wasn't he there with her? Bama asked. The moment of truth had come. I held on to hope like it was real. Daddy turned to my cousin. "If you wouldn't mind, could you bring us a bottle and some shot glasses?" "Donald Darvaux, you tell me what happened right now. I don't want to wait on whiskey," Bama said forcefully. "Your grandson was a real hero," he began, and I knew the rest.
Oh, my goodness. I'm not crying. You're crying.
I'm crying.
Janie's crying. That was beautiful. Thank you so much. This has just been a great podcast. I've so much enjoyed the craft talk and hearing about your inspirations behind both of your beautiful novels. And we want everyone to go out and purchase a copy.
Yes, it has been a marvelous discussion. Thank you, Pam. Thank you, Carol. Thank you, Rebecca. And for all of those listening in, Knee Deep and Lifelike Creatures can be purchased on our website at www.regalhousepublishing.com. The very best way to support any indie press is to buy books directly from the website, and we really appreciate your support. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider leaving us a review. We would love to hear from you. And from all of us at Regal, keep reading.